From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. Reflection and meditation won't make dark times pass more quickly, but can help people stay positive and emerge from strife with lessons learned. Dr. Robert Wicks, psychologist and professor emeritus at Loyola University, Maryland, shares insights he's gathered from decades of counseling those in helping and healing professions. His latest book is Night Call, Embracing Compassion and Hope in a Troubled World. Wicks emphasizes that taking time to be still and silent can act like a reset button.
For me, mindfulness is taking that space each day to recognize your breath, to recognize who you truly are. See, the scaffolding falls in the quiet.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Everyone encounters hardship, and how you deal with tough times determines whether or not you bounce back and what you will learn from that struggle. Our guest today, Dr. Robert Wicks, writes, quote, "It is not if we will experience darkness in a life well lived, it's when," end quote. Robert Wicks is a clinical psychologist and professor emeritus at Loyola University, Maryland. He is also author of more than 50 books. His newest is Night Call, Embracing Compassion and Hope in a Troubled World. For more than three decades, Robert Wicks has counseled those in what he calls helping professions, including relief workers who witnessed the Rwandan and Cambodian genocides, and doctors and nurses dealing with the Ebola crisis. His specialty is in building resilience and helping those who help others deal with the unique stresses of their profession. Robert Wicks, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
It's good to see you. First responders, clergy, social workers, teachers, members of the military, health workers, these are some of the helping and healing professions that you point to as rewarding but also emotionally exhausting. What are the consequences of overextending yourself emotionally?
Well, they can be dramatic. When I spoke at Walter Reed Army Hospital, one of the physicians pulled me aside at the break and he said, you know, this is starting to destroy me and my marriage. And I said, what's this? Explain it. And he said, well, I was in Afghanistan and I've come back and all I do here is cut off people's legs. He said, I wish I took a gallbladder out for a change. And he said, and I know I'm going to be deployed again. And then I go home and I try to calm down. I go upstairs, hit a few golf balls, and my wife breaks into the room and says, you don't care about us. You spend all day at work and then you come home and you're up here hitting golf balls instead of talking with us. So I said to him, what do you do when you right after work? And he looks at me, now he's angry at me. He said, you know, what do you mean, what do? I go home. And I said, well, you can't do that. I said, if you go into a restaurant and you go into the bathroom, you see a sign that says, if you work here, you need to wash your hands after you go to the bathroom. I said, when you work on the floor in the hospital in traumatic situations, you know, you need to wash your hands not only after you go to the bathroom, but before. And I said, it's the same thing with your work in general. You're becoming psychologically contaminated. As a result, you need to go home, apologize to your wife, and tell her you'll do a couple things. One is you'll take a few minutes after work to walk around the hospital or the grounds or just take a ride or sit in the car for a few moments without the radio on. And then when you get home, you're going to go up, take off your uniform, leave that role behind, and then hit a few golf balls, not to ignore her, but so you can empty yourself so you can be truly mindful. By that I mean being in the present with your eyes wide open to what's going on, not in the silver casket of nostalgia, not preoccupied with the future, but present to the now.
So widen that to, that was advice you gave a surgeon under a lot of stress. in a military hospital. How does that apply to other caregivers, and how does that apply to people who aren't even caregivers?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the last part, because in Night Call, my goal was to take the very principles that I use with caregivers and members of the military and let people apply it to their lives. So that in Night Call, I took a step aside going to the general public. An example would be the first step is to recognize when you're feeling emotion so that you can lean back. You see, the seeds of burnout and the seeds of caring for your children, your spouse, when you're an adult, your older parents, and the seeds of caring and burnout, they're the same seeds. So the caring that you feel is wonderful, but if you feel that emotional sense of anger, a sense of being overwhelmed, you need to lean back emotionally. Take a few quiet moments, listen rather than do something in those moments. You see, the opposite of detachment is not compassion, it's seduction. We're seduced by the emotions around us and the expectations of people that are often unrealistic for us. When we lean back, what we can do is then we can renew. There's an old Russian proverb that goes, when you sleep next to the cemetery, you can't cry for everyone who dies. The reality is, when those of us who deal with a lot of difficult situations know that as soon as we're feeling it, we do three things. One is we lean back emotionally and separate from the emotion. Second, we reflect on it. And third, we seek to renew ourselves so that we can re-enter with a sense of space within us. Because one of the greatest gifts we can give to others is a sense of our own peace, but we can't share what we don't have. So that would be one technique. Pick up the emotion, catch yourself, don't say or do anything at that moment, but lean back and see that as a sign that you've let yourself become contaminated by the situation.
Your focus in psychology is on resiliency. Mm-hmm. How does that shape your counseling?
It shapes it because I realize resiliency is not simply bouncing back from a situation, but leaving the possibility that from the very situation that's stressful, that you can become deeper as a person. So that I encourage the people that I see to, first of all, face the facts. Don't gloss over it, don't deny it, don't belittle the situation that is awful. If it's awful, it's awful. So never play it down. That's psychological romanticism or spiritual romanticism. The second is be open to where it can take you. What can you learn from it? When I was in Beirut working with caregivers living and working in Aleppo, Syria, that they brought to Beirut, one of the things, it was very overwhelming because they were suffering from what we call in my business traumatic countertransference, where they were trying to be God to their clients in Syria that they couldn't possibly meet their demands, and then traumatic transference. So they were transferring their anger and helplessness onto me. So when I was in that situation, I could feel it in the room. And it didn't matter. They said, we know you were in Cambodia. We know you did work with the relief workers evacuated from Rwanda during their bloody genocide. But this is different. And what I had to do in listening is say, yes, this is different. But just like the male gynecologist who's never going to know the pain of his patients, he still can do something that can help. And your job is going to be to elicit some help from me so that you can give meaning, purpose, and direction in your own life because of the very pain that you're experiencing. One of the things that happens is people see gratefulness differently.
See gratefulness differently.
Yeah, David Stendhal Rast once wrote a book on it, and he said people leave the house with a list, and on that list is what they'll be grateful for. He said throw away the list and be open to possibilities for gratefulness for other things. Well, when you've been in a war zone and you realize you have to be in, take an apartment away from the window on a lower floor, recognize that every time you go out, you take a chance of being killed, recognize that meeting with friends means that they may not see you again, you may not see them again, has you sort of really taste the water in a different way, drink the coffee in a different way, meet people in a different way. There's a sense of almost appreciation that is tied to little things that we take for granted.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with clinical psychologist, author, and professor emeritus at Loyola University, Maryland, Dr. Robert Wicks, about his new book, Night Call, published by Oxford University Press. Some of what we're talking about, and a lot of what you write about, is self-care, mm-hmm. which is kind of a buzzword these days. What do you mean by self-care?
Well, I remember what the physician and author Walker Percy said in one of his novels. He said, what if life is like a plane and you miss it? And with caregivers, professional and people who are in an intense caregiving situation at home, they often miss their own life. And it's crazy because I think that when you miss your own life, you become a poorer caregiver. So compassion involves self-compassion. So when I say self-care, I look for all kinds of opportunities, crumbs of mindfulness during the day where, let's say, I'm on a line or I'm in traffic or I'm walking to go to the bathroom or get a cup of coffee. I take a few breaths and come home to myself so that I'm there, so I'm in the now. James Joyce said of one of his characters, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. I think that's the way we live most of the time, you know? So that's what I mean by self-care. I also mean a whole array of things. I mean, what novels have we read? What movies have we seen? What museums do we belong to? Who is in our circle of friends? Because I'm convinced we need four types of friends in our network to stay afloat. And do we take out quiet time each day to center ourselves? So, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk just a bit about that part of self-care that you practice, mindfulness, meditation. How does that work? What benefits does it bring?
Well, there are many benefits that people, speak about in terms of health benefits. Rather than go into all of those, a laundry list of those, the thing that I find is that it centers me in a way that I really feel integrated when I enter the day. Even if, like this morning, I needed to get up at 4 to be down for an interview in the morning and then to be here. And when I took the quiet time at 4 o'clock, I must admit, I said to myself, you're too happy. you just feel too good for getting up at 4 in the morning, And it was because I simply centered myself in gratefulness, and I just sat there and thought, geez, what a wonderful thing it is, what a gift to be able to come and chat about what I love, which is self-care, resilience, maintaining a healthy perspective, and supporting people. So I think that for me, mindfulness is taking that space each day to recognize your breath, to recognize who you truly are. You see, the scaffolding falls in the quiet, and that's why many people initially find the time off-putting. We often think we're too busy, but that's not the case. I mean, we always find time for what we want to do. When I was just graduated from Hahnemann Medical College, my first patient was a physician who had one of the busiest practices in the city, and he came in and he was having an affair outside of marriage, and I remember at the time giving him a great Freudian analysis, If he came in to see me now, my first reaction would be, where do you get the time? The reality is we're so busy. When you're mindful, you are just as involved, but you're not busy, you're active.
Okay, but there are people who don't have much control over their schedules, who can't take a day off work, who are expected to be in place at certain times. And certainly mm-hmm. that's true of many caregivers.
True.
Many caregivers have responsibilities that are not get this done by the end of the day, but it's get it done right now.
Right.
So to say we always find time, think there are a lot of people listening to this who are thinking, there are many times I cannot take the time.
Well, that's true. And that's the reason why you don't want to add mindfulness to your schedule. The first thing you begin with is being more aware of the time that's already there. So my schedule is, I'm like a maniac, and I love what I do, so it's fine. But I'm very cautious. So before I get out of bed in the morning, I'm aware, you know, before my feet hit the ground, I take out a few moments. When I'm in the shower, I take a few moments. When I'm in traffic, there was some traffic today, I take those moments. So the first thing I tell people is, please do not add anything to your schedule for a practice of mindfulness. First, find the time that is within your schedule. And I often find that if counseling is done right, if therapy is done correctly, it's mindfulness for two. There's this real sense of, you know, people come in so driven when, you know, because of their issues. If the therapist or the physician, nurse, or helper has this sense of mindfulness, they have this space that essentially opens up the possibility to ask the question, why does it have to be done that way? So people are very busy. I mean, I'm very, but I've often changed the word busy to active just to change the tone of it. So I don't do any less, I must admit. You know, doing over 50 books proves I'm a card-carrying obsessive-compulsive. I mean,
I think so.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, that's why, you know, people look at me. A colleague of mine said, you ought to take meds for that, you know. 5 more milligrams, all that writing will go away, you know. So, but it's how you do it. It's how you do it.
That's a point on which we'll take a quick break. Give us a minute to think about this. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Dr. Robert Wicks. He's resiliency psychologist and author. We're talking about his new book, Night Call, Embracing Compassion and Hope in a Troubled World. We'll be right back.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Wicks, clinical psychologist, professor emeritus at Loyola University, Maryland, and author of Night Call, Embracing Compassion and Hope in a Troubled World. Wicks has been counseling those in caregiving professions for decades, social workers, relief workers, medical professionals. But his lessons about building up our resilience to help others are useful for everyone. His message isn't that reflection and self-care will make dark times pass more quickly, but they will help us reach the other side with something positive learned. One of the essential parts of staying emotionally healthy, you write, is nurturing friendships.
Mm-hmm.
What do friendships provide?
They provide really what I would call the stickum of life. I guess the Cameroonian proverb that's gotten famous. You know, if you want to go, fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. I find that friendship and 4 different types of friends make a difference. The first is a friendship that people don't like to hear about. It's the prophet. No one likes the prophet. Henry Thoreau once said, if you see someone coming to do good for you, run for your life, you know. But the prophet is the friend or voice of a friend that asks us, you know, what voices are guiding us in life? Who's the invisible puppeteer pulling our strings? So the prophet has you relook at your values and how you're living out of them. The second type of friend is the cheerleader, the sympathetic person who really thinks we walk on water, so that at the end of a day we can call them and say, you're not going to believe what he did today. And she'll say, well, I don't believe it, you know, and mm-hmm. You're totally right. He's totally wrong. And because we're humble, we say, well, we might have had some minuscule part to play in. And she says, no, I'm getting on my knees and praying that locusts invade his house. You're a saint. If you just have the prophet, you'd burn out. If you just have the cheerleader, you wouldn't grow. But together, they make a nice balance. And the third is the harasser or teaser, because on the way to taking your roles in life seriously, sometimes you do a detour and take yourself too seriously. And the final friend is the inspirational friend who calls us to be all that we can be without embarrassing us that we are where we are. But friendship isn't easy. When I went to India, I came back with a saying that goes, when once you've been bitten by a snake, you become cautious of even of a rope. So our friends have sometimes stabbed us in the back. But there's another saying that goes, a friend knows the song in your heart and can sing it back to you when you've forgotten how it goes. So I find that when I was working with the most difficult situations, I found the two things that people seem to rely on most was friendship, and the other was a mindfulness practice. They may have called it, if they were religious, they called it prayer. But those two factors seem to come to the surface as I travel around the world with people.
You have worked all over the world. In Beirut, you met with caregivers who were helping people in Aleppo, Syria during the bombings of 2015. You write about their feelings of anger and powerlessness. When someone is confronting such a tragedy, how can you tell them not to let it affect them?
Oh, I don't. I tell them that it is affecting them, you know, and I point out to the areas that they're feeling helpless about. And because first you need to recognize the true problem there, that it's real. You know, otherwise you're snowing them. You're just distancing them because you don't want to be in that helpless area yourself as the helper. So I tell them, no, this is something we don't have control over. And I say, but what areas do you have control over? So I shift them from seeing it all as helplessness, all as hopelessness, to what areas, you know, are still good, that they still do have some impact on. And then we focus on those. And as they focus on those, they waste less energy lamenting about what they have no control over and spend it more wisely on what they do have control over.
It seems easy for caregivers to feel defeated when they see someone continuing to struggle.
Yeah.
So how do they keep from feeling that they failed?
Well, I was with in South Africa working post-apartheid with helpers, and at the break on the talk on another book I was doing at the time called Bounce, Living the Resilient Life, this woman came up and said, I can't do it anymore. I said, well, what is it that you do? She said, I'm a social worker and I work with women who've been sexually and physically abused, and I try to get them justice. And I bring them to court, and they have to take a day off to go to court, and they're poor and often single parents. And then we get to court, and the judge, who's often male, looks at the papers and says, you know, I haven't had a chance to read this. She said, I'm a failure. And I let the emotion settle for a few moments. And I said, well, who was with that woman other than you at that point? She said, well, no one. I said, would it be an exaggeration to say that you were closer to her at that moment than anyone else in the world? She said, no, it wouldn't be an exaggeration. Then in as gentle a voice as I could muster, I said, and you want to leave that? I said, don't you understand, we're not in the success business, we're in the faithfulness business. You know, on the harder side, when I work with surgical residents, I remind them, I said, you know, during your tenure as a surgeon, you're going to kill people. It may not be through malpractice, but through mispractice, because you cannot be on 100% of the time, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. The reality is, if we didn't fail or we didn't miss something, then we'd have to give up the helping and healing professions. And it's the same thing being a parent. You know, we do our best. And it's often that we hear praise in a whisper and negative things as thunder. We focus on the negative rather than realize all the good.
I really appreciate you talking to us about it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Robert Wicks is a clinical psychologist, professor emeritus of Loyola University, Maryland, and author of more than 50 books. His latest is Night Call, Embracing Compassion and Hope in a Troubled World. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.